Thanks very much, Bill, for the introduction. And let me apologize in advance for my voice. I'm getting over a cold and haven't quite quite regained it. But the last time I was on a panel at the Philadelphia Society, the meeting was in Milwaukee. And in fact, I think that Bill Campbell was a little ahead of his time there in focusing part of that program on the progressive movement, because at that time it certainly wasn't evident that progressivism would come to be as politically relevant as, in fact, it has become today. And speaking of Wisconsin, Bill McClay mentioned Wisconsin in his opening remarks. It has been in the news of late. We've been hearing the claim there that the democratically elected governor and legislature there have acted in a way that is a repudiation of democracy. And evidently it's a novel conception of democracy that our union friends have up there in Wisconsin. And thinking about that, it raised what I thought was an important question that I wanted to get into a little bit here, and that is, what exactly is the progressive understanding of democracy? How is that understanding relevant to us today? Certainly, America's original progressives sounded the theme of democratic reform. In fact, democratization was, arguably at least, the most important theme of the progressive movement. It sought essentially to place more governing power in the hands of popular majorities. However, this progressive push for more democracy is complicated by the fact that the progressive movement was also the launching point for the modern administrative state. It helped, in other words, to put into place a system where significant portions of government decision-making are exercised not by the traditional branches of government, those that are accountable to the people through elections, but rather by unelected bureaucratic agencies that regulate with substantial independence from political control or political influence. So on one hand, the progressives sought to make the nation's traditional political institutions much more accountable to majority opinion. Yet on the other hand, they also believed that those institutions really were not capable of managing all of the new activities, all of the new tasks in which progressives wanted the national government to become involved. So under the progressive model, political institutions were to become both more democratic and really less important. And so how democratic really was national progressivism? In what ways does its reliance upon expert governance complicate its democratic principles? Well, the relevance of these questions seems to me come from the influence that this dual character of progressivism has on contemporary American government. If you think about it, American politics today maintains a near obsession with public opinion. Right? Even minute movements in benchmarks like the presidential approval rating are watched as intently as heart monitors on critical patients. And yet, while public opinion occupies such a high place, its authority is also deflected in ways that I think reflect progressive governing principles. If you think about it, in spite of the intense focus in our national political debates on the various political arguments of the day, most real governing is done in bureaucratic agencies. Matt Spaulding spoke to this briefly. Often these agencies govern in ways that defy public opinion. Certainly most of the activity in this second half of President Obama's first term will take place in regulatory agencies, right? Not in the national legislature. The real action is in Department of Health and Human Services and other places that Matt talked about. Let's take the EPA, for example. Some of you know, the EPA is presently in the process of issuing final rules regulating greenhouse gas emissions. Now, due mostly to concerns over the impact of such rules on our economy, a similar scheme of regulation was considered and failed to pass the last Congress, in fact, with strong bipartisan opposition. Yet in spite of that legislative failure, these rules are right now in the course of becoming law. Well, such a maneuver is possible, of course, because when Congress enacted the Clean Air Act and its subsequent amendments, it defined the EPA's power in such broad and vague terms that it amounted to a delegation of near plenary legislative power to that executive agency. In a similar example, you may recall that Congress in 2008 considered and voted against a taxpayer-funded bailout of major American automobile manufacturers. Nonetheless, the national government proceeded to bail out GM and Chrysler. It was able to do so because the previously enacted TARP program, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which of course was enacted for the purpose of bailing out banks and other financial service entities, that law had been written vaguely enough that the Treasury Department had ample discretion to divert funds to a wide array of entities having very little to do or really nothing to do with financial services. And many such examples, of course, could be drawn from a variety of policy areas, the point of which would be to demonstrate that so much governing today is done by expert agencies, sometimes with political support and sometimes without it. And so the tension within today's administrative state between democratic governance on the one hand and governance by unelected experts on the other, this reflects a similar tension in the democratic theory of America's original progressives. And in particular, if we look to, I think, the two most prominent national progressives, Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, I think you can see the origins of this tension. With Roosevelt, we have in Roosevelt the typical progressive critique of the Republican constitutionalism of the founders, the insistence of insistence upon very direct popular control over our national government. Yet almost implausibly, Roosevelt saw little or no conflict between his strong democratic impulse and his call at the same time for the employment of expert commissions in the national regulation of business and property. Wilson, on the other hand, while equally convinced about the necessity of pushing democratic reforms, he more readily acknowledged the uneasiness of the coexistence he envisioned between an increasingly democratized politics and an increasingly expert and powerful administrative apparatus. And in Wilson's case, the result would be, at least I would argue, a more nuanced and more realistic democratic theory, which has, as a consequence, I think, a greater relevance for contemporary American government. Let me expand just briefly on each of these figures. For Theodore Roosevelt, the Constitution's framers had obsessed about majority tyranny, and thus, in his view, they had erected a system which enshrined instead minority tyranny. Roosevelt believed that if only the majority will of the people would be allowed to prevail, then a fundamental recasting of the scope of national government would be in order. In his famous New Nationalism speech, for example, Roosevelt called for the national government to sit in judgment of whether or not a man's property was, quote, of benefit to the community. And he called for, quote, completely controlling private corporations in the interest of the public welfare. Now, how could such complete control, as Roosevelt called it, be accomplished? Well, through the use of expert agencies. When he launched his run to regain the presidency in 1912, T.R. elaborated that the key to investing such agencies with regulatory power was their expert and their nonpartisan character. The problem had been up to then that regulatory policy, to the extent that it had been practiced at the national level, was overly subject to the influence of politics. Such influence had led to unscientific policy, where special interests had too much control. And so in order to remedy that problem, Roosevelt called for the empowerment of, quote, permanent commissions of nonpartisan experts. Now, in calling for both increased popular control over national government and for removing economic policy from the legislative process and granting it to expert commissions, Roosevelt did not see a tension between these two aims. Nor did he seem to think that it called into any question what he termed the right of the people to rule. The problem was not that democratic politics itself was corrupt or unscientific, but rather that decentralized politics, particularly as it was practiced by the national legislature, that it was corrupt. Therefore, the way to ensure objective and scientific regulation was not, as Wilson was arguing at the time, through separating administration from politics altogether. Rather, it was to place ultimate accountability for expert regulating in the hands of the popular executive, the one political entity who could claim to embody the broad national will. So experts and commissions were to govern. There was no other way, Roosevelt acknowledged, for the national government to handle the many new tasks that progressives had in mind for it. But constantly, they would govern with the understanding that they answered to the people. Again, Roosevelt did not see any significant tension between policymaking by commission and rule by the people. Expert commissions could be given great power. They could be shielded from the influence of special interests by insulating them from the legislature, all while being held strictly accountable to democratic opinion. Roosevelt believed that the national government's new powers of economic control could be made democratic by concentrating ultimate responsibility for them in the president, that is to say, in himself. Now, in looking to the presidential leader, as the key to balancing democracy and expert governance, Roosevelt certainly would have something in common with Woodrow Wilson. Like Roosevelt, Wilson believed that the American system of government was too undemocratic. And also like Roosevelt, he pinned blame on the framers' obsessive fear of majority tyranny. This had led the framers to restrict the people from using the power of the national government as an instrument of their will. Yet while Roosevelt's favored remedy for this undemocratic character of our original system of government was to advocate direct popular means of circumventing institutions altogether, mechanisms such as the ballot initiative, referendum, and so on, Wilson preferred to reform the institutions themselves. He suggested new ways of conceiving of American political institutions that would facilitate a functional, if not formal, demise of the checks on national government, which were inherent in the separation of power system. The only means of bringing genuine democracy to American government, Wilson made clear, were, quote, certainly none other than those rejected by the Constitutional Convention. So he called for a more popular government. And he even railed against Roosevelt in 1912 for Roosevelt's advocacy of expert commissions. Yet, of course, when Wilson assumed office, most of his major domestic initiatives involved the very kind of regulation by commission that Roosevelt had advocated in the New Nationalism. In fact, Wilson's agenda looked so much like that on which Roosevelt had campaigned that one Roosevelt scholar has remarked that it was, quote, exceedingly embarrassing to the Progressive Party. Wilson had stolen its thunder and much of its excuse for being. As much as Wilson's domestic agenda was a sharp departure from the attacks on commission government that Wilson had made as a candidate, President Wilson was not actually setting off in any new direction. Instead, he was reverting to an embrace of expert administration, which he had developed and endorsed throughout his voluminous writings on government, and from which his presidential campaign had been a politically expedient and temporary diversion. So as intense as Wilson's Democratic rhetoric could get, it turns out he did not think that Democratic politics would be of the greatest importance in the modern democratic state. He believed that the progressive force of history had already brought about an implicit popular agreement on what was wanted out of government. Once, therefore, the people's will was emancipated, the real task of government would become administration. So in championing the importance of educated experts, of their independence from political influence, and of their being given, at least to some degree, a role in governing, the obvious question is how one squares this with Wilson's fervently stated democratic principles. Now, while Roosevelt seems not to have acknowledged this conundrum, Wilson understood that he actually needed to deal with the question of public opinion. Wilson sought to maintain the veneer of popular government while giving, at the same time, wide berth to administrators. The greatest obstacle to the necessary growth of administration, Wilson candidly acknowledged, is what Roosevelt had called the right of the people to rule. Asked Wilson, quote, "What then is there to prevent this much to be desired science of administration?" And he answered, quote, "Well, principally, popular sovereignty." If progressive governance was to involve the exercise of at least some authority over policymaking by unelected experts, then, as Wilson acknowledged, expert governance would somehow have to be reconciled with progressive democratic principles. Now, this was true for Roosevelt as well, even if he did not quite see the difficulty in the way that Wilson did. For both men, the key to this reconciliation seems to have come from their notions of leadership. Roosevelt's notion, I think, was much more populist in tone and in its actual character than Wilson's. It was also arguably more simplistic and, I think, self-serving. Wilson, like Roosevelt, spoke to the necessity of a popular leader embodying the unified public mind. Yet, Wilson had reflected much more thoroughly on this question, and his conception of democratic leadership included not only the president as a popular focal point, but an entire class of administrators as discerners of the public's objective will. Wilson actually cast democratic rule in terms of expert or elite governance. While administrative agencies might not comport with traditional notions of democracy, Wilson believed that administration was democratic in a much deeper sense. Civil service experts would not be distracted by special interest contentions that existed in ordinary politics. They would be free instead to discern the true and implicit will of the public as a whole. Administrators, he believed, would be in the best position to adjust the policy of the government to what the people really wanted. Right? They would be able to see through the special interests. Now, in thinking about administration in this way, as a means of reconciling democratization and expert governance, Wilson, I think, thought in terms that have proved to be more relevant to contemporary American government than Roosevelt did. Popular presidential leadership, championed by both Wilson and Roosevelt, has certainly proved to be a central feature of American politics. But the delegation of significant policymaking authority to expert administrative agencies, which has also become a staple of American government, was thought through much more comprehensively by Wilson. This is not to suggest that today's administrative governance is fully or even mostly Wilsonian. Legislators are far too involved in agency decision-making. Politics is still far too dominant, certainly to have satisfied Wilson's model. But rather that contemporary American governance seems to reflect the dilemma between the democratic impulse and the deference to expertise that Wilson identified and that he thought it necessary to confront. Thank you.